I thought we'd start with a bit of fun. So could we have a picture up? There we go. You've seen these before. Some of you may not have seen them. But when you look at that picture, what do you see? Do you see a duck? Okay, yeah, you see the duck. But if you just turn your head very slightly, what else do you see? You see a rabbit. There's a rabbit there, right? Can everyone see the rabbit now? Yeah, yeah, yeah. You getting it? Okay, let's have the next picture. Ah, one of my favourites, this. Okay, so can you see the old woman?
Yes.
We don't have anybody like that here. But can you see the old woman? Can you see the young woman?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay, brilliant. So, you know, some of us will see part of the picture, but we won't see the whole thing clearly. Talk to me afterwards if you don't see both. Let's have the next one. Ah, now, FedEx. I like this one. Who has ever seen the arrow in the FedEx symbol? Yeah. Can you see the arrow? There's an arrow in every FedEx symbol. Yeah, you got it? If you look in the X, the EX, there's an arrow in the middle there. Yeah, you got it? Yeah, it's there every time, but we miss it, don't we? We see the picture, but we don't see it clearly. And here's my favourite one. We've done. Oh, there we go, there it is. And here's my last one. Right, okay. You've seen this, right? Don't tell your friends if you've already seen this. But did you know that on every Toblerone bar there is a bear? Have you seen the bear? On every Toblerone? Yeah, there it is. It's there every time. Just go on to the... Has we got the next? There we go. There he is. Okay? So it's all about, you know, seeing part of the picture. But do you see everything clearly? So let's take the pictures down. And just turn to that first reading now, please. Let's have it in front of us. And there's a blind man who wants Jesus to heal him. And verse 23, Jesus leads the man out of the village. The village is a place called Bethsaida. Jesus spits and puts his hands on the man. Is the man healed? Yes, he is. Verse 24, he says, I can see. I can see people, but they look like trees walking around. It's a strange thing to say. The point is, he can see, but he can't see clearly. The people look like trees. So verse 25, Jesus touches him again. And then we're told, the man saw everything clearly. It's a healing that very unusually takes two goes. It takes two touches. And you may well say, well, so what? Why in the world do I need to know that? He's healed. That's all he cares about. True. But the story is there to illustrate something else. The story is there to illustrate something much, much, much more important for you and me. Let me show you. Immediately, we get this conversation between Jesus and his disciples. The same men who were in the boat last week. It's James and John and Andrew and Peter. They have seen everything Jesus has done. But have they seen clearly? End of verse 27. Jesus asks this very gentle question. End of verse 27. Who do people say I am? Well, some people say you're John the Baptist. Some people say that you're Elijah. Some people say that you're one of the other prophets. But suddenly, Jesus changes the tone. Verse 29, never mind them. What about you? Who do you say I am? And you know, that is a very different question, isn't it? That's the difference between walking along the street with your friend and saying, do you think anyone will ever marry me? And saying, will you marry me? It's quite a difference between those two questions, isn't there? And that's what happens here. Who do you say I am? And Peter, who is a member of the League of Men who will always put their foot in it. Do you know anyone like that? He knows. So he sticks his hand up and he says, I know exactly who you are, Jesus. You are the Christ. You're not just a man. You're not just a healer. You're not just a teacher. I can see, says Peter, that you are God's king. You are the Messiah. You are the Christ. It's a massive moment. Peter has seen. But has he seen everything clearly? He sees that Jesus is the king. But for Peter, that means glory and good things. When Peter says, "You are the Christ," what Peter means is a conquering Christ who will redden the mountains with the blood of his enemies. But in that second reading, Jesus says, no, the reddening is going to be in my blood. So do turn over to that second reading. That would be really great. And right at the top, he then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer and die. He began to teach them that their need and ours is so deep, it is so appalling, that nothing else can sort it out. If Jesus avoids the cross, which is what Peter's king must do, then Jesus cannot pay the penalty for sin, and he cannot be a substitute for sinners. If Jesus avoids the cross, which is what Peter wants, then Jesus saves himself, but he can't save anybody else. So friends, the thing is, when you look at Jesus, what do you see? When you look at Jesus, do you see a wise man? Do you see a good example to follow? Do you see someone to turn to when life is hard, which it often is? All of those things are right there. They're in the picture. That's who Jesus is. But do you see, please do you see, that the very heart of Christianity is a king who suffers? And Peter is not happy. Peter is not happy at all, because he now sees where all this is going. I don't know if you thought about it, but when you choose a leader, you want a leader who is successful, don't you? Not a leader who suffers. Because if you commit to following a leader who is successful, then there's a good chance that you will share in that leader's success. But if you commit to following a leader who suffers, you will suffer too. That's where this is going. And in case you still haven't got it, Jesus makes it absolutely stone cold clear. Verse 34, fantastic verse, he says, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. No wonder Peter told him off. It is a call to suffer. And nobody wants that, do they? We say, don't we, suffering is a bad thing, suffering is to be avoided. But Jesus says, you really call yourself my follower? Really? Really? Then where I go, you go. And the place I go is the cross. And the place I go, says Jesus, is a place of suffering and humiliation. You probably won't die. But Jesus says, you must die to self. You must die to self. And some of us know that, don't we? But I suspect there are so many of us sitting here this morning who have never seen that being a Christian involves suffering and sacrifice. We think, don't we, that so much of the time Christianity is about being at church. Christianity is about being good or feeling good. Christianity is about being respectable or being respected. This really is a wake-up call. You see, every one of us, including me and every one of us, we have drunk deeply from the world's well of self-fulfillment and self-indulgence and self-interest. We have got to rediscover Christ-like self-denial. See that word self? That's the key word. On holiday, I was reading some stuff about this guy called Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He was a pastor in Germany during the 1930s. And during the 1930s, the Nazis pretty much took over the German church. They They redefined Christianity and they redefined the church in their image. And that was possible because sadly so many pastors and so many congregations went along with it. But a very large number of pastors, like this guy Dietrich Bonhoeffer, they saw exactly where it was going. They knew that it was completely incompatible with biblical Christianity and they would have nothing to do with it. And countless numbers of them, including this guy Bonhoeffer, were executed. There's so much more that I could say about him. But before he died, he wrote a book called The Cost of Discipleship. And it was a book about these verses in Mark chapter 8. And the cost, you could call that book The Cost of Following Jesus. That's what discipleship is. The cost of following Jesus. And one of his huge points in that book is, beware of cheap grace. Cheap grace, he says, is the preaching of forgiveness without repentance. Cheap grace is grace without discipleship, it's grace without the cross, and it's grace without Christ. The authentic gospel, he says, the true gospel is costly grace. Such grace is costly because it calls us to follow. Such grace is costly because it costs a man his life. And it is grace because it gives a man the only true life. It is costly because it condemns sin, and it's grace because it justifies the sinner. But above all things, he says, costly grace is costly because it cost God the life of his Son, and something that costs God so very much cannot be cheap for us. Do you see? Have you seen the full picture? But there's more. There's more. There's so much more. Because it turns out that the self-sacrifice Jesus calls us to is not self-sacrifice at all. Because if you read on verse 35, this is what it says. Whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. Do you know, every inch of the Bible, every single word of the Bible has an eternal perspective. And so you've got Jesus, the King and the Lord of Lords, okay, the most powerful man who ever lived, and he had no wife, no family, no property, no money. All he had to look forward to was a life of suffering and death. That's all he had. How on earth did he keep going? How? By setting his eyes on the glory that was beyond the cross. See, it turns out that the life of self-sacrifice that Jesus calls us to is actually the life of self-preservation. You deny yourself. You take self off the throne. You follow Jesus. And hey, hey, extraordinary, counterintuitive. That is actually the way you inherit Jesus' life and Jesus' glory. How do you persevere in a difficult family? How do you persevere in a difficult marriage? In the teeth of so much opposition, how do you keep saying no to sex outside marriage? How do you keep teaching that? How do you keep taking a stand on that when the world says no? How do you face the grief that talking to people about Jesus can bring you? How do you face the grief when you invite people to come to church or to something or anything and they keep saying, no, I'm not interested? Here's a good one. How do you deny your children what their friends all have so that gospel ministry can happen? How do you do it? There's only one way that any of us will ever do it, and that is Christ-like self-sacrifice. We really, really need to know. There is no other authentic Christian life. We have pretended for so long that there is, but there isn't. Forgiveness is free, but the Christian life, following Jesus in this life, is very costly. It will cost your time, it will cost your money. It will cost your comfort. It will cost your pride. It will cost your reputation. It will cost you this thing called self. I read a story about a doctor who was a very big noise in a very big church. He was a big, powerful, important man. Everyone looked up to him. Sometime later, he had an affair. He divorced his wife. He abandoned his children. He gave up absolutely everything to do with biblical Christianity. Countless attempts were made to reach out to him. What had gone wrong? Well, the most thoughtful assessment was given by one of the leaders of his former church. He said, everything in this man's life had been easy. At every point, he had been supported and praised so that he never, for the sake of Christ, ever made a decision that cost him anything. So when troubles opened up in his marriage, as they do, and when a more attractive option came along, as it does, he had no moral centre on which to depend. He had never made a costly decision before, and he was jolly well not going to make one now. Do you know, we live. I don't know if you would believe this, but you and I live in an obsessively self-interested culture. That is the world we inhabit. That is the air that we breathe, day in, day out, day in, day out. I heard the other day about someone here in the UK. She is so in love. She's so in love that in a formal ceremony, she married herself. And Jesus says, give it up. Give it up. You won't find life there. You will find it. It's so counterintuitive. He says you will find life when you lose it. You'll find life when you count the cost and follow me, he says. Now, I know this won't apply for all of us, but it's really worth asking yourself this morning. Have I ever made a costly decision for Christ? Have I ever made one? With my money, with my time, with my energy. That is what true Christian discipleship is. It's making decisions. It's not being a doormat. It is making costly decisions to follow a crucified Messiah. And maybe that will be a commitment for you to being in church every Sunday. Maybe that will be costly. Maybe it will be costly to drag out to a meeting or a Bible study or a practice. Or maybe it will mean a commitment to avoiding or stopping a relationship that is unhelpful. Or maybe it will mean repairing a difficult relationship. Or maybe, God forbid, it will be sorting out your giving. Only you know what a costly decision will be for you. But can I just finish with this? There's another way that this applies, because I know there are people here this morning and you've made countless costly decisions for Christ, and what you want to know is it worth it? Yeah? Don't you? You know it's a cost and you make it. Is it worth it? Well, let me give you this story. I'm going to finish with this. I love this story. You've heard it before, maybe, but I was at a seminar on science and Christianity, and it was given by this very, very clever man who I happen to know. He's a scientist, a physicist. And one of the big points that he made was the staggering improbability that this universe arose by accident. See, I never knew this, but it's wonderful when you hear it from such a clever scientist that the universe being created, but coming out of nothing, at random chance, is staggeringly improbable. And he illustrated it by using a pound coin. Okay? Now, it was in the days when we had the old pound coins. I don't know if it works with the new one, but I've got an old one here. Okay, so he said, I want you to cover the whole of North America in pound coins. In your mind, I want you to cover the whole of North America with pound coins. And he said, can you think about that? And when you've done that, I want you to pile all these pound coins up to the height of the moon. Can you do that? Okay? And then he said, I want you to do that with 1 billion other continents the size of North America. That's becoming quite difficult, isn't it? And then he said, what I want you to do is, when you've got all these billions and billions and billions of pound coins, I want you to paint one of them red, and I want you to insert it somewhere in all of those billions of coins, and then I want you to blindfold your best friend and ask him to find it. The probability that your friend will find it is the same as the probability that this universe came into being by accident. Do you know, that is a scientist simply being honest. There are many dishonest scientists, but that is an honest one. And as he explained this, as he went through this extraordinary illustration, he was overcome. And I was overcome at the magnitude of this, because what is it telling us? There is a God who is infinite and huge and massive and extraordinarily powerful. Why would you not follow this God? Why would you not listen when he calls you to go through any cost or suffering? This is not Ernest Shackleton and his polar expedition, safe return doubtful. This is the God of the universe. The outcome here is secure because of who has promised it, and Christ will have the prize for which he died, an inheritance of nations. So church, arise and put your armor on and go for it, because it is worth it, but it is costly. Sorry. Amen.